Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We could not reestablish our line with Dr. Elizabeth Economy from the Council on Foreign Relations, so we thank her very much for coming on and talking about China. Now we're going to talk about think tanks. What are think tanks anyway? And do they really think?
The Heritage Foundation.
Thank from the Center for American Progress.
The Cato Institute explained.
And of the Brookings Institution.
The Global del Cato Institute.
Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. This is what they show.
So Senator Jim DeMint announced last week that he's leaving the Senate and taking the reins of the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, to have more influence on government that he could have than he could have as a U.S. senator. Here he is explaining the move to CNN's Wolf Blitzer.
After this last election, it's apparent that we need to do more as conservatives to convince Americans that our ideas and our policies are going to make their lives better. The Heritage Foundation is the premier think tank research organization, the premier idea group for the conservative movement.
But what's a conservative think tank? What's a think tank? Conservative, liberal, otherwise, what do they think? And what role do they play in shaping public policy in Washington? Joining us now is Murray Wiedenbaum. He's a professor at Washington University in St. Louis and author of The Competition of Ideas, The World of the Washington Think Tanks. He was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy and Chairman of President Reagan's first Council of Economic Advisors. He's got a toe in the world of think tanks himself as well. Professor Wiedenbaum, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Nice to talk to you.
And listeners, anything you've ever wanted to know about think tanks but didn't know who to ask, 212-433-WNYC. So what exactly is a think tank? The title of your book is The Competition of Ideas. Does that suggest that they are generating ideas, thinking new thoughts, thinking at all?
Well, in my book, I've used the wisecrack. Some of them do more tank than think.
Huh.
Nevertheless, in each of the think tanks, to different proportions, and I include Heritage in that, each of them has lots of independent thinkers who don't necessarily hew the party line. In fact, some of the major think tanks are proud of the fact there is no party line, that there's a great variety of competition of different ideas within the tank, so to speak. Frankly, I was dismayed to see the senator talk about resuming the war of ideas, because Ed Foehner, who is leaving, retiring as president of Heritage, has written about the fact that that's behind us. There's a new, more, he didn't use the term cooperative, but a more open relationship in the ideas being tossed about by the various think tanks.
I see you've got a toe or two in this world. You're a member of advisory boards of the Center for Strategic Tax Reform.
Let me correct that. I spent 40 years in and out of think tanks, always part-time or on sabbatical. I've retired from all of them, so I have no ties. And that's that was true for writing the book. I'm now, I think, knowledgeable, but independent of all the think tanks.
Okay. And you were associated with the American Enterprise, I see, the Council on Foreign Relations, and some others. So what's the best case scenario for the role they play in shaping public policy?
The major think tanks not only develop, but synthesize ideas because there's such a cross flow between academia and the think tanks, so that they're in the position of getting into the public policy debate, especially in Washington, key ideas from a great variety of sources, including their own scholars.
So would you say that the best think tank for you would be a non-ideological, pragmatic think tank looking to solve problems. But is there any such thing in the real world?
Not really. Each of them has a different orientation. That's why there really is a competition of major ideas across the think tank world. I think that's healthy.
Let's take a phone call. George in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Hi, yes. I'm imagining that operating a think tank is very expensive. What is their business model? Do they sell something or just beg other people for money?
Well, they sell. First of all, there are many reasons for donating to a think tank. One is to support a particular group of thinkers. To many organizations, especially corporate, think tanks are very useful in broadening the thinking of the management of a specific, say, manufacturing company based in the Midwest. They open up horizons. They present an opportunity for company management to interact with thinkers and policymakers, especially in the Washington area.
So when he asks about the money, to follow the money trail a little bit more, do the people who fund think tanks tend to have ideological agendas? Do they tend to have interests, such as corporate interests, that they want policy to advance? Or how would you separate those kinds of things?
Well, first of all, what I find fascinating is Heritage and Cato to a second degree, but Heritage primarily has such a wide base of support. Thousands and thousands of people provide each modest amounts of funding, but in total they have a larger proportion of their revenue from around the country and a smaller dependence on business than, say, the more moderate Brookings Institution.
How do you explain it?
The folks who really developed Heritage, and Ed Follner, the outgoing CEO, is number one in terms of building the organization from scratch. He'd been in Washington long enough to understand the basis for influence and an organization that isn't tied to a small group of funders but has a wide funding base, has an intellectual independence that is very helpful in getting your case across in the public policy arena.
And still on this issue of funding, we had David Bowes of the Cato Institute on the show this spring to talk about that public rift between the libertarian think tank and two of its biggest supporters, who happen to be the Koch brothers. Charles Koch is one of the founders of the Cato Institute, and he sued the think tank earlier this year to get more control of the libertarian organization. Here's David Bowes talking about it.
Six of the seven people they've managed to place on our board are financially dependent on Koch Industries. That's not so much packing the board with conservatives, it's just packing it with people who are not independent of Koch interests.
So it again raises the question of who controls the think tanks and what do they think they're getting out of it?
Well,
what did you make of that Cato incident?
I was not happy about that. Having spent time in think tanks, you know that Cato has a libertarian viewpoint, but that there are discussions and debates within the Institute on specific issues, and that's healthy, and having an external board dominated by one group doesn't eliminate the opportunity for that competition of ideas, but it inhibits it. That's the tank aspect of being a think tank. It's a force to propel a given set of positions on public policy.
With the news that Jim DeMint is going to head the Heritage Foundation think tank, we're talking to Murray Wiedenbaum, author of The Competition of Ideas, The World of the Washington Think Tanks, to ask, what is a think tank anyway, and how much do they really think? How much do they really engage in open-minded exploration, the thing we usually call thinking? Joel in Union, you're on the air. Hi, Joel.
Yeah, hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was watching the wonderful movie Heist, Who Stole the American Dream, by Francis Causey and Donald Goldmacher, and they make the point that think tanks were actually invented as a response to the infamous Lewis Powell memo of 1972, where he outlines a rather detailed strategy for reversing the New Deal for the benefit of the wealthy and corporations. And in fact, he gives us the example that the whole notion of the death tax for the inheritance tax was developed in the think tank. It may have been Heritage, I'm not sure. They tested it out, and they saw that it had wide resonance, and people who were nowhere near the income level affected by it could get very angry about it and give the Republicans the drive, the boost to oppose it. So I'd like to know from this gentleman if there's a range of think tanks, if any are not simply focus group devices to develop conservative selling points. I guess it's an extension of what you're saying, and I think it's important to say where they came from, and I believe that they were largely in response to this memo, this Powell memo.
Well, first of all, the term death duties, I teach public finance, so this is really something I've studied over the decades. Goes back into public finance literature a couple hundred years. So no one at any of these think tanks invented the term death duties. That's a standard public finance term for inheritance taxes. Brookings was the pioneer Washington think tank, and still is one of the major ones. They were set up by Robert Brookings after World War I, if I recall.
With what in mind at that time? If we assume that it wasn't in the same kind of polarized politics context.
Brookings had a strong point of view. They even had journalists on their payroll to promote the Budget and Accounting Act of 1921. That was their pet theme for a while. But you don't find real purists among the think tanks. But American Enterprise Institute started during World War II, for example, 1940-something. You'll find quite a bit of competition across the think tank world.
And I asked John Podesta on this show, former Clinton chief of staff, about whether think tanks really think anymore. When he was on the program from the Democratic National Convention this summer, he, of course, is founder of the Center for American Progress, a liberal or progressive think tank. And here's his answer from the end of that interview.
I think we set the strategy in papers we wrote in 2005 and 2006 on how to exit Iraq, which then Senator Obama embraced and has executed as president. We've been trying to be a positive force in generating ideas for moving the country towards cleaner energy, towards expanded health coverage.
So I got the sense from Podesta and some other people who I've spoken to from more liberal think tanks in recent years that a few like Heritage and Cato had become so powerful from the right that there's been this conscious effort in more recent years to set up think tanks that are more left-leaning, specifically to try to have a counterweight in the area of public policy influence. So you get Center for American Progress, you get Demos, you get a few more of those, specifically with that in mind. Is that your understanding?
Well, I don't think that's a complete situation, because you find the Center for Strategic and International Studies, one of the big five, at least that's my view of it, that's very nonpartisan, that has senior analysts across the political spectrum. You go to the American Enterprise Institute. Over the years, it's had senior scholars who debate each other. I spent time in both of those institutes on sabbatical. To think that there's a strong ideological commitment on the part of the AEI or CSIS scholars, not in the time I've spent a year at a time there, very frankly. Now, are there? I don't know. Podesta is a relatively new one. I have no personal experience with. So I really can't comment. I feel a little uncomfortable to hear the head of a think tank be that politically directed. I'm not aware that it represents the typical major think tank in Washington. But what I welcome, and I think is healthy, is the array. That's why I called the phenomenon the competition of ideas. What I think is healthy is the array of different political, economic, social views that are expressed in the think tank world, and they don't hesitate to criticize each other, and I think that's vital to maintain a certain quality control.
Everything you always wanted to know about think tanks but had no one to ask. 212-433-WNYC for Murray Wiedenbaum, author of The Competition of Ideas, The World of the Washington Think Tanks, and Bobby in Williamsburg. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Maybe your guest could clarify this for me, but I've heard there's a direct affiliation with the Heritage Foundation and Coors Brewing Company. So if that's true, essentially every time you're drinking a Coors beer, you're supporting conservative causes. Is that true?
I don't think so. My understanding is that Joe Coors was one of the original financiers of Heritage to get it off the ground.
Right.
But Heritage, certainly Ed Follner, takes great pride in turning down funds from people who want to impose a specific policy position on them that they feel uncomfortable with. Certainly people who want to oppose free trade are regularly turned down by, I think, all of the major think tanks.
Yeah, and yet Joe Coors had an important role. I'm looking at the Heritage site right now, and there's a quote on here: without Joe Coors, the Heritage Foundation wouldn't exist, and the conservative movement
it
nurtures
true.
Would be immeasurably poorer. So I guess, Bobby, if people want to figure out the political leanings of all the owners of the companies whose products we buy and choose on that basis, then, you know, then there's a lot of research to do.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you very much. By the way, what about the money before you go? It's been in the news that when Senator DeMint announced that he's going to be taking the top post at the Heritage Foundation, a list of the top paid think tanks, think tank positions surfaced, and the current president of Heritage has been making over $1 million a year. That's on the very highest end. John Podesta, who we mentioned from the Center for American Progress, former White House Chief of Staff, made reportedly $275,000. The head of the New America Foundation, Steve Call, $330,000. What do you think about that range?
The range is much wider, but the top of the range is, at least when I studied it, which ended in 2008, was that the top end of the range was defined by a competition between AEI and Heritage as to who is the highest paid think tank CEO. And a million sounds about where that top number is.
This
is
in
public
information. A class by himself?
Well, Heritage and AEI are top of the list, at least over the years. And Brookings is much further down. CSIS is much further down. So is Cato. for that matter. And there's a wide range, and Podesta is well within the range of the major think tanks.
At 275. One more call. Randall in Brooklyn, you're on the air. Hi, Randall.
Hi, Brian. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great.
My question about think tanks, and as a consumer of kind of think tank information via the NewsHour, for example, on PBS, when an issue comes up for discussion and it's of interest and it could be on any range of topics, media outlets dial 1-800-THINK-TANK and they get the Cato Institute and somebody opposite on the spectrum, and they both talk over each other over the center of the issue, and no new information or understanding actually results. Is there any way that that can be addressed?
Great question. Murray, what do you think about the way the media uses think tanks?
Well, it's an easy way, because think tanks are geared to be responsive to media, because that's a major way of disseminating their views, their analysis, to the ultimate audience, which are public policy decision makers.
And I played a clip of Senator DeMint from an interview with CNN's Wolf Blitzer earlier. In that interview, Wolf asked him straight out if he thought he would have more influence on policy as the head of a think tank than as a member of the United States Senate, and DeMint said yes. Do you agree with him? And
yes and no. And the reason I say that, I've done some case studies that indicate the wide variety of people who influence a major piece of legislation, like, say, a major tax bill. At different stages, different think tankers are the influential type. Sometimes an academic, often staffs of the committees, and individual senators and congressmen. So there isn't. When you look at a single important bill, there isn't one father of the idea, so to speak. There's a whole array of people who influenced the basic idea, or got the Congress to hold hearings, or came up with a compromise when there was a deadlock on the bill. So many different people from the think tank world and elsewhere were involved in almost any major piece of legislation.
Murray Weidenbaum from Washington University in St. Louis, author of The Competition of Ideas, The World of the Washington Think Tanks. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.